smiled despite herself. She would never have found this secret place on her own. Likely not a single person had ever done what she was about to do. She shot to the surface for a breath of air, then dived back down and pulled herself through the opening. It was dark in this tunnel, black, and the water was even colder than the water in the pool. She could see nothing. She kicked forward through the tunnel and counted steadily. Rocks scratched her arms, and she felt in front of her with her hands to avoid cracking her head against anything unexpected. It was narrow, but not dangerously so. Poe would have no trouble if he were well enough to swim. As her count neared the number 30, the passageway widened, and then the tunnel walls disappeared all around. She shot upward, hoping to break through the surface, for she didn't know where to find the air of this black cave if it wasn't straight above. She was conscious now of her sense of direction, at which Poe had always marveled. If she lost the tunnel in this darkness, and if she couldn't find an opening to the surface, it was over for Katza. But Katza knew exactly where the tunnel was, behind her and below her. She knew how far she'd gone and in what direction. She knew up and down, east and west. The darkness wouldn't claim her. And of course, Poe would never have sent her into this cave if it were a place she could not endure. Her shoulder hit rock, and she heard a muffled slap that sounded like surface water on shore. She kicked forward toward the sound, and then her head burst above water, and she was breathing. She felt around and found the rock whose underside she'd struck. It jutted above the surface and felt flat and mossy on top. She pulled herself onto it, teeth chattering. It was blacker in this cave than any night she had ever known. There was not a flash on the water, not even a thinner blackness to give shape to the space around her. She stretched her arms, but touched nothing. She had no sense of the height of the ceiling or the depth of these walls. She thought she heard water slapping against rock for some distance, but she couldn't be sure without exploring. And she wouldn't explore, because they hadn't the time. So this was Poe's cave. He would be safe enough here, if he could get himself here, for no one who didn't share his grace could ever find him in this cold, black hole under the mountain. Katza slipped back into the icy water and dived for the tunnel. She came ashore with a pair of wriggling fish in her hands.
I found your cave. It'll be easy enough for you to manage, if by some wonder of medicine and healing you're able to swim. The tunnel is just below the fall of water. And here's your dinner.
She threw the fish onto the rocks and dried herself with a cloth Bitter Blue brought to her. She dressed. She held out her hand for Poe's knife, and he tossed it to her. She beheaded the fish and cut them open. She threw the entrails back into the pond.
You must go now. There's no point in delay.
There's some point in delay. What'll you eat after these fish are gone?
I'll manage.
Katza snorted.
You'll manage? You don't even have a bow. And even if you did, I'd like to see your aim right now. We'll not leave until you've plenty of food and firewood.
Katza, honestly, you must go. You simply must.
The horse needs the rest of a morning. From now on, it will ride hard and...
She refused, simply refused, to give in to the panic that rattled around inside her.
And winter's coming, and you can make me leave you here, but you can't make me leave you here to starve to death.
Poe rubbed his eyes. He sighed.
You'll need a lot of firewood. I'll get started,
Bitter Blue said, and Poe laughed outright.
I'm outnumbered. Very well, Katza. Do what you must. But before morning passes, you'll be on your way.
The morning was a whirlwind. The faster Katza moved, the less she could think, and so she moved as fast as her feet and her fingers were capable of. She caught him two rabbits, which he could cook with the fish that night and store safely for a number of days. She cursed the weather. It was cold enough for Poe to be uncomfortable during the day, when he couldn't risk a fire. But it wasn't cold enough for freezing meat, nor did they have salt to treat it. She couldn't kill him meat now to last the winter, or even to last him a number of weeks. And in a number of weeks the hunting would become difficult for even those hunters who walked steadily on their feet and carried a bow.
Have you ever made a bow?
Never.
I'll find you the wood before we leave. And you'll have the hides of these rabbits to reinforce the stave and for the string. I'll explain to you how it's done.
She cursed herself for the feathers she'd discarded from all of the birds she'd killed. But when her rushed passage over the rocks disturbed a roost of quail, she swept stones up from the ground and managed to knock the majority of them down. They would be Bitterblue's dinner and her own, and Poe would have the feathers for arrows. When she found a young tree with strong, flexible limbs, she chose a curved piece for the bow and some long, straight branches for arrows. And then she had a thought. She cut more branches and split them apart. She began to weave a sort of basket, square, with sides, top, and bottom about the length of her arm. She wove it tightly, with small openings between the slats. When she came back to the pool where Poe still sat and Bitterblue still scrambled for firewood, she carried the basket on one shoulder and the quail and the branches under her other arm. She cut a couple of lengths of rope and tied them to the edges of her basket. She lowered the basket into the pool, just deep enough that it couldn't be seen, and tied the ropes to the base of a bush on shore. Then she pulled off her boots, her coat, and her trousers, and prepared herself once more for the icy shock of the water. She dived. She hung suspended under the water and waited and waited. When a fish flashed nearby, she grabbed. She swam to the basket and slid back the slats. She squeezed the wriggling fish inside and fastened the slats again. She dived back down, snatched another fish, swam to shore, and deposited the squirming body into the basket. She caught fish for Poe, so many fish that by the time she was done, the basket swarmed with their crowded bodies.
"You may have to feed them,"
she said, once she'd returned to shore and dressed.
"But they should last you some time."
"And now you must go."
"I want to make you crutches first."
"No, you'll go now."
"I want—"
"Katza, do you think I want you to go? If I'm telling you to go, it's because you must."
She looked into his face and then looked away.
"We need to divide our belongings."
"Bitterblue and I have done that."
"I must dress your shoulder one last time."
"The child has already done so."
"Your water flask—"
"It's full."
Bitterblue came over the top of the rise then and joined them.
"The cabin is bursting with firewood."
"It's time for you to go,"
Poe said, and he leaned forward, balanced himself, and stood. Katza bit back her protests and gave him her shoulder. Bitterblue untied the horse, and they made their way back to the cabin.
"Your balance is better,"
Katza thought to him.
"Come with us."
"Cousin, don't let her run the horse ragged, and be sure she sleeps and eats every once in a while. She'll try to give all the food to you."
"As you have done,"
Bitterblue said, and Poe smiled.
"I've tried to give you most of the food. Katza will try to give you all of it."
They stopped at the entrance to the cabin, and Poe leaned back against the door frame.
"Come with us,"
Katza thought as she stood before him.
"They'll be on your tail. You must not let them get close enough to talk to you. Think about disguising yourself. You're dirty and bedraggled, but any fool would recognize either of you. Katza, I don't know what you can do about your eyes, but you must do something."
"Come with us."
"Bitterblue, you must help Katza if she's confused by any words she hears. You must help each other. Don't trust any Monsian, do you understand? You mustn't trust anyone who may have been touched by Lex Grace. And don't for a moment think you can defeat him, Katza. Your only safety is in escaping him. Do you understand?"
"Come with us."
"Katza."
His voice was rough, yet gentle.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"I understand,"
she said, and when a tear trickled down her cheek, he reached out and wiped it away with one finger. He studied her face for a moment, and then he turned to Bitterblue. He bent down on one knee and took her hands.
"Farewell, cousin."
"Farewell,"
the child said gravely. He stood again, gingerly, and leaned back against the door frame. He closed his eyes and sighed. He opened his eyes and looked into Katza's face. His mouth twitched into the slightest grin.
You've always intended to leave me, Katza.
She choked on a sob.
How can you joke? You know this isn't what I meant.
Oh, Katza. Wildcat.
He touched her face. He smiled so that it hurt her to look at him, and she was sure she couldn't leave him alone. He pulled her close and kissed her, and he whispered something into her ear. She held onto him so hard that his shoulder must have ached, but he did not complain. Katza didn't look back as they rode away, but she gripped Bitterblue tightly, and she called out to him, his name bursting inside her so painfully that for a long while she could feel nothing else. Chapter 29. They followed the edges of the Monsian Mountains and pushed the poor horse south. They ran occasionally over open land, but more often than not their progress was slowed by cliffs, crevices, and waterfalls, places where there was no footing whatsoever for the horse. There, Katza needed to dismount, backtrack, and lead the beast to lower ground. And then the hair would stand on the back of her neck, and every sound would stop her breath. She couldn't breathe freely until they'd climbed again. For the lower land gave way to the forest, and Katza knew the forest must be swarming with Lek's army. The army would comb the forest, the port road, and the land between. They would comb the mountain pass at the border of Sunder and Estel. They would make camp in Monport and watch the ships that came and went, searching any ship likely to be hiding the kidnapped daughter of the king. No, as the day turned to evening, Katza knew she was fooling herself. They would search every ship, suspicious or not. They would search every building in the port city. They would comb the coastline east of Monport and west to the mountains and search every ship that chanced to approach the Monsian shore. They would tear the leaned ships apart. And within a day or two, Katza and Bitterblue would be sharing the base of the Monsian peaks with hordes of Lek soldiers. For there were only two paths out of Monsi, the sea and the mountain pass on the Sunder and Estolin border. If the fugitives weren't found on the port road or in the forest, if the fugitives had not appeared on the mountain pass, in Monport or aboard a ship, then Lek would know they were in the mountains, trapped by forest and sea, with the peaks that formed the border of Monsi and Sunder at their back. When night fell, Katza built a small fire against a wall of rock.
Are you tired?
Yes, but not terribly,
the child said.
I'm learning to sleep on the horse.
You'll have to sleep on the horse again tonight, for we must keep moving. Tell me, princess, what do you know of this mountain range?
The range that divides us from Sunder? Very little. I don't think anyone knows much about these mountains. Not many people have gone into them. Except up north, of course, at the pass.
Katza dug through her bags and unearthed the roll of maps. She flattened them in her lap and flipped through them. Clearly, Raffin had taken Poe at his word when Poe said he wasn't sure where they were going. She thumbed past maps of Nander and Wester, maps of Drowden City and Burn City, a map of Sunder and another of Mergen City, numerous maps of various parts of Monsi. She pulled a curling page out of the pile, laid it on the ground beside the fire, and dropped stones onto its edges to hold it flat. Then she sat back on her heels and studied the princess, who stood guard over the roasting quail. There were people in all seven kingdoms with gray eyes and dark hair. Bitterblue's coloring was not unusual. But even in the dim glow of the fire, she stood out, her straight nose and the quiet line of her mouth. Or was it the thickness of her hair? Or the way the hair swept itself back from her forehead? Katza couldn't quite decide what it was, but she knew that even without hoops in her ears or rings on her fingers, the child had something of the leaned in her appearance, something that went beyond her dark hair and light eyes. In a kingdom searching desperately for the 10-year-old child of a Leonid mother, Bitterblue would be very difficult to disguise. Even once they did the obvious, cut her hair, change her clothes, and turn her into a boy. And the child's companion was no less of a problem. Katza didn't make as convincing a boy in daylight as she did in the dark, and she would have to cover her green eye somehow. A feminine boy with one very bright blue eye, an eye patch, and a Leonidish child charge would attract more attention in daylight than they could possibly weather. And they couldn't afford to travel only at night. And even if they made it as far as Monport without being seen, once they were seen, they would be recognized instantly. They would be apprehended, and she would have to kill people. She would have to commandeer a boat or steal one, she who didn't know the first thing about boats. Lek would hear of it and know exactly where to find them. Her eyes dropped from the princess to the map on the ground before her. It was a map of the Sundaran-Monsian border, the impassable Monsian peaks. If Poe were here, he would suspect what she was thinking. She could imagine the monstrous argument they would be having. She imagined the argument because it helped her to come to her decision. When they'd eaten their dinner, she rolled up the maps and fastened their belongings to the saddle.
Up you go, Bitterblue. We can't waste this night. We must move on.
Poe warned you not to run the horse ragged.
The horse is about to enjoy a very thorough rest. We're heading into the mountains, and once we get a bit higher, we'll be setting him free.
Into the mountains? What do you mean, into the mountains?
Katza scattered the remains of their fire. She dug a hole with her dagger to hide the bones of their dinner.
There's no safety for us in Monsi. We're going to cross the mountains into Sunder.
Bitterblue stood still beside the horse and stared at her.
Cross the mountains? These mountains? Here?
Yes. The mountain pass at the northern border will be guarded. We must find our own passageway here.
Even in summer, no one crosses these mountains. It's almost winter. We have no warmer clothes. We have no tools. Only your dagger and my knife. It's not possible. We'll never survive.
Katza had a response to that, though she knew none of the particulars. She lifted the girl into the saddle and swung onto the horse behind her. She turned the animal west.
I will keep you alive.
They didn't really have only one dagger and one knife to bring them over the Monsian peaks into Sunder. They had the dagger and the knife, a length of rope, a needle and some cord, the maps, a fraction of the medicines, most of the gold, a small amount of extra clothing, the ratty blanket Bitterblue wore, two saddlebags, one saddle, and one bridle. And they had anything that Katza could capture, kill, or construct with her own two hands as they climbed. This, first and foremost, should include the fur of some beast to protect the child from the nagging cold they encountered here and the dangerous cold that awaited them. And that Katza wouldn't dwell on, because when she dwelled, she began to doubt herself. She would make a bow and possibly snowshoes, like the ones she'd worn once or twice in the winter forests outside Randa City. She thought she remembered how the snowshoes looked and how they worked. When the sky behind them began to lighten and color, Katza pulled the child down from the horse. They slept for an hour or so, huddled together in a mossy crevice of rock. The sun rose around them. Katza woke to the sound of the girl's teeth chattering. She must wake Bitterblue, and they must get moving. And before the day was out, she must have a solution to the cold that gave this girl no rest. Bitterblue blinked at the light.
We're higher. We've climbed in the night.
Katza handed the child what was left of yesterday's dinner.
Yes.
You still have it in your head for us to cross the mountains.
It's the only place in Monsi Lek won't search for us.
Because he knows we'd be mad to try it.
There was something petulant in the child's tone. The first hint of complaint from the girl since Katza and Poe had found her in the forest. Well, she had a right. She was tired and cold. Her mother was dead. Katza spread the map of the Monsian Peaks across her lap and said nothing.
There are bears in the mountains.
The bears are asleep until spring.
There are other animals, wolves, mountain lions, animals you've not seen in the Midlands. And snow you've not seen. You don't know what these mountains are like.
Between two mountain peaks on Katza's map was a path that seemed likely to be the least complicated route into Sunder. Grella's Pass, according to the scrawled words, and presumably the only route through the peaks that had been traveled by another. Katza rolled up her maps and slipped them into a saddlebag. She hoisted the girl back up into the saddle.
Who is Grella?
Bitterblue snorted and said nothing. Katza swung onto the horse behind the child. They rode for a number of minutes before Bitterblue spoke.
Grella was a famous Monsian mountain explorer. He died in the pass that bears his name.
Was he graced?
No, he wasn't graced like you. But he was mad like you.
The sting of the remark didn't touch Katza. There was no reason for Bitterblue to believe that a graceling who'd only recently seen her first mountain could guide them through Grella's pass. Katza herself wasn't sure of it. She knew only that when she weighed the danger of the King of Monsi against the danger of bears, wolves, blizzards, and ice, she found with utter certainty her grace to be better equipped to face the mountains. So Katza said nothing, and she didn't change her mind. When the wind picked up and Katza felt Bitterblue shivering, she drew the child close and covered her hands with her own. The horse stumbled its way upward, and Katza thought about their saddle. If she took it apart and soaked it and beat it, its leather would soften. It would make a rough coat for Bitterblue, or perhaps trousers. There was no reason to waste it if it could be made to provide warmth. And very soon the horse would need it no longer. They climbed blindly, even during the day, never knowing what they might encounter next, for the hills and trees rose before them and hid the higher terrain from their view. Katza caught squirrels and fish and mice for their meals, and rabbits if they were lucky. Beside their fire every night, she stretched and dried the pelts of their dinners. She rubbed fish oils and fat into the hides. She pieced together the pelts, experimenting with them and persisting until she'd made the child a rough fur hood with ends that wrapped around her neck like a scarf.
It looks a bit odd,
Katza said when it was done and the child tried it on.
But vanity doesn't strike me as one of your qualities, princess.
It smells funny, but it's warm.
That was all Katza needed to hear. The terrain grew rougher and the brush wilder and more desperate looking. At night, as the fire burned and Bitterblue slept, Katza heard rustles around their camp that she hadn't heard before. Rustles that made the horse nervous, and howls sometimes, not so far away, that woke the child and brought her shivering to Katza's side, admitting to nightmares. About strange howling monsters, and sometimes her mother, she said, not seeming to want to elaborate. Katza didn't prod. It was on one of these nights, when the sound of the wolves drove the child to Katza, that Katza set down the stick she was whittling into an arrow and put her arm around the girl. She rubbed warmth into Bitterblue's chapped hands. And then she told the child, because it was on her own mind, about Katza's cousin Raffin, who loved the art of medicine and would be 10 times the king his father was, and about Helda, who had befriended Katza when no one else would, and thought of nothing but marrying her off to some lord, and about the council. And the night Katza and Al and Gidden had rescued Bitterblue's grandfather, and Katza had scuffled with a stranger in Mergen's gardens and left him lying unconscious on the ground, a stranger who'd turned out to be Poe. Bitterblue laughed at that, and Katza told her how she and Poe had become friends, and how Raffin had nursed Bitterblue's grandfather back to health, and how Katza and Poe had gone to Sunder to unravel the truth behind the kidnapping, and followed the clues into Monsi and to the mountains, the forest, and the girl.
You weren't really like the person in the stories I heard before I met you.
Katza braced herself against the flood of memories that never seemed to lose their freshness and always made her ashamed.
The stories are true. I am that person.
But how can you be? You wouldn't break an innocent man's arm or cut off his fingers.
I did those things for my uncle, at a time when he had power over me.
And Katza felt certain again that they were doing the right thing, to climb toward Grella's pass, to the only place Lek wouldn't follow. Because Katza couldn't protect Bitterblue unless her power remained her own. Her arm tightened around the girl.
You should know that my grace isn't just fighting, child. My grace is survival. I'll bring you through these mountains.
The child didn't answer, but she put her head on Katza's lap, curled her arm onto Katza's leg, and burrowed against her. She fell asleep like that, to the howl of the wolves, and Katza decided not to pick up her whittling again. They dozed together before the fire, and then Katza woke and lifted the girl onto the horse. She took the reins and led the beast upward, through the Monsian night. The day came when the terrain grew impossible for the horse. Katza didn't want to kill the animal, but she forced herself to consider it. There was leather to be gotten from him, and if he were left alive, he would wander the hills and give the soldiers who found him a clue to the fugitive's location. On the other hand, if Katza killed the horse, she couldn't possibly dispose of his entire body. They would have to leave the carcass on the mountainside for the scavengers. And if soldiers found it, its bones picked clean, it would serve as a much more definite marker of their location and direction than a horse wandering free. Katza decided with some relief that the horse must live. They removed his bags, his saddle, and his bridle. They wished him well and sent him on his way. They climbed with their own hands and feet, Katza helping Bitterblue up the steepest slopes and lifting her onto rocks too big for her to climb. Thankfully, on the day she'd slid down the walls of her castle clinging to knotted sheets, Bitterblue had worn good boots. But she tripped now over her ratty dress. Finally, Katza cut the skirts away and fashioned them into a crude pair of trousers. The girl's passage after that was faster and less frustrating. The saddle leather was stiffer than Katza had anticipated. She fought with it at night while Bitterblue slept, and finally decided to cut the girl 4 makeshift leggings, one for each lower leg and one for each upper leg, with straps to tie them in place over the trousers. They looked rather comical, but they gave her some protection from the cold and the damp. For more and more often now, as they trudged upward, snow drifted from the sky. Food became scarce. Katza let no animal go to waste. If something moved, she brought it down. She ate little and gave most of their food to Bitterblue, who gobbled down whatever she was given. In the light of each morning, Katza removed the girl's boots and checked her feet for blisters. She inspected the girl's hands to make sure that her fingers weren't frostbitten. She rubbed ointment into Bitterblue's cracked skin. She handed Bitterblue the water flask every time they stopped to rest. And Katza stopped them often for these rests, for she began to suspect that this child would collapse before admitting she was tired. Katza was not tired. She felt the strength of her arms and legs and the quickness of her blade. She felt most acutely the slowness of their pace. At times she wanted to hoist the child over her shoulder and run up the mountainside at full tilt. But Katza suspected that eventually on this mountain she would need every bit of her graceling strength, and so she must not exhaust herself now. She curbed her impatience as best she could and focused her energies on providing for the child. The mountain lion was a gift, really, coming as it did at the beginning of the first true snowstorm they encountered. The storm had been building all afternoon, the clouds knitted together. The snowflakes swelled and sharpened. Katza made camp at the first possible place, a deep crevice in the mountain, sheltered by a rocky overhang. Bitterblue went off to collect kindling, and Katza set out, her dagger in her belt, to find them some dinner. She struck a path upward, over the sheet of rock that formed the roof of their shelter. She headed into one of the clumps of trees that grew skyward on this mountain, roots clinging more to rock than to soil. Her senses were alert for any movement. What she saw first was the slightest flicker in the corner of her eye, a brown flicker up high in a tree, a flicker that curled and lifted, different somehow from the way a tree branch moved, and the limb of a tree that swung in an odd way, bounced really, not as a wind would move it, but as if something heavy weighed it down. Her body moved faster than her mind, recognizing predator and comprehending itself as prey. Instantly her dagger was in her hand. The great cat plunged, screeching, and she hurled the blade into its stomach. As she dropped and rolled away, its claws tore into her shoulder. Then the cat was upon her, great heavy paws slamming her shoulders against the ground and pinning her to her back. It came snarling at her, claws swiping and teeth bared, so fast that it was all she could do to keep her chest and neck from being ripped apart. She wrestled with its hopelessly strong forearms and swung her head away as its teeth came crashing together right where her face had just been. It slashed her breast savagely. When its teeth lunged for her throat, Katza grabbed its neck and screamed, pushed its snapping jaws away from her face. The animal reared above her and raked her arms with its claws. She saw a flash of something in its stomach and remembered the dagger. Its teeth descended again, and Katza swung out, smashing its nose with her fist. It recoiled for the merest second, stunned, and in that second she reached desperately for the dagger. The cat lunged again, and Katza thrust the dagger into its throat. The cat made one horrible hissing, bubbling noise. Then it collapsed onto Katza's chest, and its claws slid away from her skin. The mountain was quiet, and the lion was dead. Katza heaved the cat away. She propped herself onto her right elbow and wiped the animal's hot blood out of her eyes. She tested her left shoulder and winced at the pain. She choked back an enormous surge of irritation that she should now have an injury that might slow them down, and she tore open her coat and sighed, disgusted, at the gashes in her breast that stung almost as badly as those in her shoulder. And other rips and tears, she realized now, as each movement uncovered a new sting. Smaller cuts on her neck and across her stomach and arms, deeper cuts in her thighs, where the cat had pinned her with its hind feet. Well, there was no reason to lie around feeling sorry for herself. The snow was falling harder now. This fight had brought her injury and inconvenience, but it had also brought food that would last them a good long time, and fur for a coat that Bitterblue very much needed. Katza heaved herself to her feet. She considered the great lion that lay dead and bloody before her. Its tail, that's what she'd seen lifting and curling in that tree, the first clue that had saved her life. From head to tail, the cat was longer than her height, and she guessed it weighed a good deal more than she did. Its neck was thick and powerful, its shoulders and back heavily muscled. Its teeth were as long as her fingers, and its claws longer. It occurred to her that she had not done so badly in this fight, despite what Bitterblue would think when she saw her. This was not an animal she would have chosen to fight in hand-to-hand combat. This animal could have killed her. She realized then how long she had left Bitterblue alone, and a gust of wind blew thickening snow into her face. She pulled the dagger from the cat's throat, wiped it on the ground, and slipped it into her belt. She rolled the cat onto its back and grasped one of its forelegs in each hand. She gritted her teeth against the ache in her shoulder and dragged the cat down to their cave. Bitterblue ran up from the camp when she saw Katza coming. Her eyes widened. She made an unintelligible noise that sounded like choking.
"I'm all right, child. It only scratched me."
"You're covered in blood."
"Mostly the cat's blood."
The girl shook her head and pulled at the rips in Katz's coat.
"Great seas,"
she said when she saw the gashes in Katz's breast.
Great seas,
she whispered again at the sight of Katza's shoulder, arms, and stomach.
We'll have to sew some of these cuts closed. Let's clean you up. I'll get the medicines.
That night, their camp was crowded, but the fire warmed their small space and cooked their cat steaks and dried the tawny pelt that would soon become Bitterblue's coat. Bitterblue supervised the cooking of the meat. They would carry the extra, frozen, as they climbed. The snow fell harder now. The wind gusted snowflakes into their fire, where they hissed and died. If this storm lasted, they'd be comfortable enough here. Food, water, a roof, and warmth. They had all they needed. Katza shifted so that the fire's heat would touch her and dry the tattered clothing she'd put on again after washing, because she had nothing else to wear. She was working on the great bow she'd been making for the past few days. She bent the stave and tested its strength. She cut a length of cord for the string. She bound the string tightly to one end of the stave and pulled on it hard to stretch it to the other end. She groaned at the ache in her shoulder and the soreness of her leg where the bow pressed into one of her cuts.
If this is what it's like to be injured, I'll never understand why Poe loves so much to fight me. Not if this is how he feels afterwards.
I don't understand much of what either of you do.
Katza stood and pulled experimentally at the string. She reached for one of the arrows she'd whittled. She notched the arrow and fired a test shot through the falling snow into a tree outside their cave. The arrow hit the tree with a thud and embedded itself deeply.
Not bad. It will serve.
She marched out into the snow and yanked the arrow from the tree. She came back, sat down, and set herself to whittling more arrows.
I must say I'd trade a cat steak for a single carrot, or a potato. Can you imagine what a luxury it's going to be to eat a meal in an inn once we're in Sunder, Princess?
Bitterblue only watched her and chewed on the cat meat. She didn't respond. The wind moaned, and the carpet of snow that formed outside their cave grew thicker. Katza fired another test arrow into the tree and tramped out into the storm to retrieve it. When she stamped back again and knocked her boots against the walls to shake off the snow, she noticed that Bitterblue's eyes still watched her.
What is it, child?
Bitterblue shook her head. She chewed a piece of meat and swallowed. She pulled a steak out of the fire and passed it to Katza.
You're not acting particularly injured.
Katza shrugged. She bit into the cat meat and wrinkled her nose.
I've been fantasizing about bread myself.
Katza laughed. They sat together companionably, the child and the lion killer, listening to the wind that drove the snow outside their mountain cave. Chapter 30. The girl was exhausted. Warmer now in the hide of the cat, but exhausted. It was the never-ending upward trudge and the stones that slid under her feet, pulling her back when she tried to go forward. It was the steep slope of rock that she couldn't climb unless Katza pushed her from behind. And it was the hopeless knowledge that at the top of this slope was another just as steep, or another river of stones that would slide down while she tried to climb up. It was the snow that soaked her boots and the wind that worked its way under the edges of her clothing. And it was the wolves and cats that always appeared so suddenly, spitting and roaring, tearing toward them across rock. Katza was quick with her bow. The creatures were always dead before they were within range, sometimes before Bitterblue was even aware of their presence. But Katza saw how long it took Bitterblue's breath to calm and grow even again after each yowling attack, and she knew that the girl's tiredness stemmed not only from physical exertion, but from fear. Katza almost couldn't bear to slow their pace even more, but she did it because she had to.
It's no use if our rescue kills him.
Al had said the night they'd rescued Grandfather Tilif. If Bitterblue collapsed in these mountains, the responsibility would be Katza's. It snowed hard now, almost constantly, and so now when it snowed, they kept moving. Katza wrapped Bitterblue's hands in furs and her face so that only her eyes were exposed. She knew from the map that there were no trees in Grella's pass. Before they reached that high, windy pathway between the peaks, the trees would end. And so she began to construct snowshoes, so that she wouldn't find herself needing them in a place with no wood to make them. She planned to make only one pair. She didn't know what terrain they would find in the pass, but she had an idea of the wind and the cold. It wouldn't be the place to move slowly, unless they wanted to freeze to death. She guessed she would be carrying the child. At night, Bitterblue sank immediately into an exhausted sleep, whimpering sometimes, as if she were having bad dreams. Katza watched over her and kept the fire alive. She pieced together slats of wood and tried not to think of Poe. Tried, and usually failed. Her wounds were healing well. The smallest ones barely showed anymore, and even the largest had stopped losing blood after a few hours. They were no more than an irritation, though the bags she carried pulled on the cuts, and the half-constructed snowshoes banged against them. Her shoulder and her breast protested a bit every time her hand flew to the quiver on her back, the quiver she'd fashioned with a bit of saddle leather. She would have scars on her shoulder and her breast, possibly on her thighs, but they would be the only marks the cat left on her body. She would make some sort of halter next, when she was done with the snowshoes, in anticipation of carrying the child. Some arrangement of straps and ties made from the horse's gear, so that if she must carry Bitterblue, her arms would be free to use the bow. And perhaps a coat for herself, now that Bitterblue was warmer. A coat from the next wolf or mountain lion they encountered. And every night, with the fire stoked and her work done, and thoughts of Poe so close she couldn't escape them, she curled up against Bitterblue and gave herself a few hours' sleep. When Katza found that she was shivering herself to sleep at night, wrapping her own head and neck with furs and stamping the numbness out of her feet, she thought they must be nearing Grella's pass. It couldn't be much farther, because Grella's pass would be even colder than this, and Katza didn't believe the world could get much colder. She became frightened for the child's fingers and toes and the skin of her face. She stopped often to massage Bitterblue's fingers and her feet. The child wasn't talking and climbed numbly, wearily, but her mind was present. She nodded and shook her head in response to Katza's questions. She wrapped her arms around Katza whenever Katza lifted her or carried her. She cried with relief when their nightly fire warmed her. She cried from pain when Katza woke her to the cold mornings. They had to be close to Grella's pass. They had to. Because Katza wasn't sure how much more of this the child could endure. An ice storm erupted one morning as they trudged upward through trees and scrub. For the better part of the morning they were blind, heads bent into the wind, bodies battered by snow and ice. Katza kept her arm around the child, as she always did during the storms, and followed her strong sense of direction upward and westward, and noticed, after some time, that the path grew less steep, and that she was no longer tripping over tree roots or mountain scrub. Her feet felt heavy, as if the snow had deepened and she must push her way through it. When the storm lifted, as abruptly as it had begun, the landscape had changed. They stood at the base of a long, even, snow-covered slope, clear of vegetation, the wind catching ice crystals on its surface and dancing them up into the sky. Some distance ahead, two black crags towered to the left and right. The slope rose to pass between them. The whiteness was blinding, the sky so close and so searingly blue that Bitterblue held her hand up to block her eyes. Grella's pass. No animals to fend off, no boulders or scrub to navigate, only a simple rising length of clean snow for them to walk across, right over the mountain range and down into Sunder. It almost looked peaceful. A warning began to buzz and then clamor in Katza's mind. She watched the swirls of snow that whipped along the pass's surface. For one thing, it would be a greater distance than it looked. For another, there would be no shelter from the wind. Nor would it be as smooth as it seemed from here, with the sun shining on it directly. And if it stormed, or rather, when it stormed, it would be weather befitting these mountaintops, where no living thing survived, and all that had any hope of lasting was rock or ice. Katza wiped away the snow that clung to the girl's furs. She broke pieces of ice from the wrapping around Bitterblue's face. She unslung the snowshoes from her back and stepped into them, wrapped the straps around her feet and ankles, and bound them tightly. She untangled the halter she'd constructed and helped the child into it, one weary leg at a time. Bitterblue didn't protest or ask for an explanation. She moved sluggishly. Katza bent down, grabbed her chin, and looked into her eyes.
Bitterblue, Bitterblue, you must stay alert. I'll carry you, but only because we have to move fast. You've got to stay awake. If I think you're falling asleep, I'll put you down and make you walk. Do you understand? I'll make you walk, Princess, no matter how hard it is for you.
I'm tired,
the child whispered, and Katza grabbed her shoulders and shook them.
I don't care if you're tired. You'll do what I tell you. You'll put every ounce of strength into staying awake. Do you understand?
I don't want to die,
Bitterblue said, and a tear seeped from her eye and froze on her eyelash. Katza knelt and held the cold little bundle of girl close.
You won't die. I won't let you die.
But it would take more than her own will to keep Bitterblue alive, and so she reached into her cloak and pulled out the water flask.
Drink this, all of it.
It's cold.
It will help to keep you alive. Quickly, before it freezes.
The child drank, and Katza made a split-second decision. She threw the bow onto the ground. She pulled the bags and the quiver over her head and dropped them beside the bow. Then she took off the wolf furs she wore over her shoulders, the furs she'd allowed herself to keep and wear only after the child was covered in several layers of fur from head to toe. The wind found the rips in Katza's blood-stained coat, and the cold knifed at her stomach, at the remaining wounds in her breast and her shoulder. But soon she would be running, she told herself, and the movement would warm her. The furs that covered her neck and head would be enough. She wrapped the great wolf hides around the child like a blanket.
You've lost your mind.
And Katza almost smiled, because if the girl could form insulting opinions, then at least she was somewhat lucid.
I'm about to engage in some very serious exercise. I wouldn't want to overheat. Now give me that flask, child.
Katza bent down and filled the flask with snow. Then she fastened it closed and buried it inside Bitterblue's coats.
You'll have to carry it if it's not to freeze.
The wind came from all directions, but Katza thought it blew most fiercely from the west and into their faces. So she would carry the child on her back. She hung everything else across her front and pulled the straps of the girl's halter over her shoulders. She stood under the weight of the child and straightened. She took a few cautious steps in the snowshoes.
Ball up your fists,
she said to the girl,
and put them in my armpits. Put your face against the fur around my neck. Pay attention to your feet. If you start to think you can't feel them, tell me. Do you understand, Bitterblue?
I understand.
All right, then. We're off.
She ran. She adjusted quickly to the snowshoes and to the precariously balanced loads on her back and her front. The girl weighed practically nothing, and the snowshoes worked well enough once she mastered the knack of running with legs slightly splayed. She couldn't believe the coldness of this passageway over the mountains. She couldn't believe wind could blow so hard and so insistently, without ever easing. Every breath of this air was a blade gouging into her lungs. Her arms, her legs, her torso, especially her hands. Every part of her that was not covered with fur burned with cold, as if she had thrown herself into a fire. She ran, and at first she thought the pounding of her feet and legs created some warmth, and then the incessant thud, thud, thud became a biting ache, and then a dull one. And finally she could no longer feel the pounding at all, but forced it to continue, forward, upward, closer to the peaks that always seemed the same distance away. The clouds gathered again and pummeled her with snow. The wind shrieked, and she ran blindly. Over and over she yelled to Bitterblue. She asked the girl questions, meaningless questions, about Monsey, about Lex City, about her mother. And always the same questions about whether she could feel her hands, whether she could move her toes, whether she felt dizzy or numb. She didn't know if Bitterblue understood her questions. She didn't know what it was Bitterblue yelled back. But Bitterblue did yell, and if Bitterblue was yelling, then Bitterblue was awake. Katza squeezed her arms over the child's hands. She reached back and grasped the child's boots every once in a while, doing what she could to rub her toes. And she ran and kept running, even when it felt like the wind was pushing her backward, even when her own questions began to make less and less sense, and her fingers couldn't rub, and her arms couldn't squeeze any more. Eventually, she was conscious of only two things: the girl's voice, which continued in her ear, and the slope before them that she had to keep running up. When the great red sun sank from the sky and began to dip behind the horizon, Katza registered it dully. If she saw the sunset, it must mean the snow no longer fell. Yes, now that she considered the question, she could see that it had stopped snowing, though she couldn't remember when. But sunset meant the day was ending. Night was coming, and night was always colder than day. Katza kept running, because soon it would be even colder. Her legs moved. The child spoke now and again. She could not feel anything except the coldness stabbing her lungs with each breath. And then something else began to register in the fog of her mind. She could see a horizon that lay far below her. She was watching the sun sink behind a horizon that lay far below her. She didn't know when the view had changed. She didn't know at what point she had passed over the top and begun to descend. But she had done it. She couldn't see the black peaks anymore, and so they must be behind her. What she could see was the other side of the mountain, and forests, endless forests, and the sun bringing the day to a close as she ran, the child living and breathing on her back, down into Sunder. And not too far ahead of her, the end of this snowy slope, and the beginning of trees and scrub, and a downhill climb that would be so much easier for the child than the uphill climb had been. She noticed the shivering then, the violent shivering, and panic consumed her, racked her dull mind awake. The child must not sicken now, not now that they were so close to safety. She reached back and grabbed Bitterblue's boots. She screamed her name. But then she heard Bitterblue's voice crying something in her ear, and she felt the girl's arms snake around her front and hold her tight. The line below her breasts where Bitterblue's arms encircled her felt different suddenly. Warm. Oddly warm. Katza heard her own teeth chattering. She realized that it was not the girl who shivered. It was herself. She found herself laughing, though nothing was funny. If she couldn't even keep herself alive, there was no hope for the child. She shouldn't have let this happen. She'd been mad to bring them into Sunder this way. She thought of her hands and held them up to her face. She opened her fingers, forced them to open, and cursed herself when she saw her white fingertips. She shoved her fists into her armpits. She willed her mind to think clearly, lucidly. She was cold. Too cold. She must get them to the place where the trees started, so that they could have firewood and protection from the wind. She must start a fire. Get to that place and start a fire. And keep the child alive. Those were her needs. Those were her ends. And she would keep those thoughts in her head as she ran. By the time they reached the trees, Bitterblue was whimpering from numbness and cold. But when Katza collapsed to her knees, the girl unwound herself from the halter. She fumbled to remove the wolf furs from her own back and wrapped them around Katza's body. Then she knelt before Katza and tugged at the straps of the snowshoes with her chapped, bleeding fingers. Katza roused herself and helped with the straps. She crawled out of the snowshoes and flung off the bags, the quiver, the halter, and the bow.
Firewood! Firewood!
The girl sniffled and nodded and stumbled around under the trees, collecting what she could find. The wood she brought back to Katza was damp with snow. Katza's fingers were slow and clumsy with her dagger, unsteady with the shivering that racked her body. She had never in her life had difficulty starting a fire before. Never once in her life. She concentrated fiercely, and on her 10th or 11th try, a flame sparked and caught a dry corner of wood. Katza fed pine needles to the flame and nursed it, directed it, and willed it not to die, until it licked at the edges of the branches she'd assembled. It grew and smoked and crackled. They had fire. Katza crouched, shivering, and watched the flames, ignoring fiercely the stabbings of pain they brought to her fingers and the throbbing in her feet.
No,
she whispered, when Bitterblue stood and moved away to find more firewood.
Warm yourself first. Stay here and warm yourself first.
Katza built up the fire slowly, and as she leaned over it, and as it grew, her shivering quieted. She looked at the girl, who sat on the ground, her arms wrapped around her legs. Her eyes closed, her face resting on her knees, her cheeks streaked with tears. Alive.
What a fool I am. What a fool I am.
She forced herself to her feet and pushed herself from tree to tree to collect more wood. Her bones ached, her hands and feet screamed with pain. Maybe it was for the best that she'd been so foolish, for if she'd known how hard this would be, perhaps she wouldn't have done it. She returned to their campsite and built the fire up more. Tonight, the fire would be enormous. Tonight they would have a fire all of Sunder could see. She shuffled over to the child and took her hands. She inspected the girl's fingers.
You can feel them? You can move them?
Bitterblue nodded. Katza yanked at the bags and groped inside them until she found the medicines. She massaged Raffin's healing ointment into the girl's cracked, bleeding hands.
Let me see your feet now, princess.
She rubbed warmth into the girl's toes and buttoned her back into her boots.
You've made it across Grella's pass, all in one piece. You're a strong girl.
Bitterblue wrapped her arms around Katza. She kissed Katza's cheek and held on to her tightly. If Katza had had enough energy for astonishment, she would have been astonished. Instead, she hugged the girl back numbly. Katza and Bitterblue held on to each other, and their bodies crawled their ways back to warmth. When Katza lay down that night before the roaring fire, the child curled in her arms. Not even the pain in her hands and feet could have kept her awake. Part 3. The Shifting World. Chapter 31. The inn sat in what passed for a clearing here in the south of Sunder, but would have been called a forest anywhere else. There was space between oaks and maples for the inn, a stable, a barn, and a patch of garden, and enough open sky to allow sunlight to flicker down and reflect the surrounding trees in the windows of the buildings. The inn wasn't busy, though neither was it empty. Traffic through Sunder was always steady, even at winter's outset, even at the edge of the mountains. Cart horses labored northward, pulling barrels of Monsian cider, or the wood of Sunder's fine forests, or the ice of Sunder's eastern mountains. Merchants bore leaned tomatoes, grapes, apricots, leaned jewelry and ornaments, and fish found only in leaned seas, north from the Sunder and port cities, up into the Midlands, to Wester, Nander, and Estel. And southward, from those same kingdoms came freshwater fish, grains and hay, corn, potatoes, carrots, all the things the people who live in the forests want, and herbs and apples and pears and horses to be loaded onto ships and transported to Leaned and Monsey. A merchant stood now in the yard of the inn, beside a cart stacked high with barrels. He stamped his feet and blew into his hands. The barrels were unmarked, and the merchant nondescript, his coat and boots plain, none of his six horses bearing a brand or ornamentation indicating from which kingdom they came. The innkeeper burst into the yard with his sons, gesturing to them and to the horses. He yelled something to the merchant, and his breath froze in the air. The merchant called back, but not loudly enough to carry to the thick stand of trees outside the clearing, where Katza and Bitterblue crouched, watching.
"He's likely to be Monsian, come up from the ports and making his way through Sunder. His cart is very full. If he'd come from one of the other kingdoms, wouldn't he have sold more of whatever he's carrying by now? Excepting Leaned, of course. But he doesn't have the look of a Leaned, does he?"
Katza rifled through her maps.
"It hardly matters. Even if we determine he's from Nander or Wester, we don't know who else is at the inn, or who else is likely to arrive. We can't risk it, not until we know whether one of your father's stories has spread into Sunder. We were weeks in the mountains, child. We've no idea what these people have heard."
"The story may not have reached this far, or some distance from the ports and the mountain pass. And this place is isolated."
"True, but we don't want to provide them with a story either, to spread up to the mountain pass or down to the ports. The less Lek knows about where we've been, the better."
"But in that case, no inn will be safe. We'll have to get ourselves from here to Leaned without anyone seeing us.